Welcome to the WebMD podcast, where inspiration meets innovation. I am your host, Dr. Antonio Webb. Join us as we explore the journeys of remarkable individuals who have overcome challenges and who have achieved extraordinary success in and out of the medical field. Each episode, we delve into the experiences, insights, and wisdom that have shaped these inspiring lives. Whether you're in medicine or simply seeking motivation, this podcast is your go-to source for uplifting stories and powerful lessons. Let's embark on this journey together and be inspired by these incredible people who are making a difference in the world. This is the WebMD Podcast. All right. Welcome back to the WebMD Podcast. Today we have a very special guest, and he's going to tell us about his story and his kind of path to plastic surgery. How did he get there? Kind of what is it like to be a plastic surgeon and kind of what he does in a day in and day out basis? Dr. Pierce, what's up, man? I want to welcome you to the WebMD Podcast.
Thanks, man. It's been a hot minute since we've seen each other.
Yeah, it's been a while. I remember the last time we saw each other was it's probably about six months ago.
Yeah. It's been a little while, but I mean, you and I have known each other since residency.
That's right.
University Hospital.
Yeah.
And I think you and I met like probably what, 2015, 2016 or so?
Yeah, I think I was probably like a second or third year resident. Yeah. And you were in plastic surgery residency, and I was in orthopedics. And it's funny how you become friends and stay friends with people that you train with in your residency. So you, big time plastic surgeon out in Austin, man. Congratulations on all your success. That's awesome.
Thanks. Yeah. It's been 6 years over there now. Opened my practice right out of training, which some days I'm like, that was the best thing I've ever done. And some days I'm like, that was probably the dumbest thing I've ever done. But it's, you know, nothing great comes easy. So, but yeah, it's a great place to live. It's a great place to work and enjoy being there.
Yeah. So, and then I guess tell the folks, like growing up, did you always want to be a plastic surgeon or something that you just kind of stumbled upon after medical school or during medical school?
So, yeah, I mean, I grew up, my whole life kind of grew up in the medical field. My dad's a gastroenterologist, so, and my brother and I both grew up in that. So, got through college, and then once it came time to apply to medical school, got through that, and then time to apply for residency. Well, I figured, you know what, general surgery was a lot of fun. They let me do a ton of things in general surgery, so I was like, let me just try for that. By the time I got through, like, my second year of general surgery training, I was like, this really isn't for me, the whole knife and gun club kind of trauma stuff. It just, I don't know, I didn't really enjoy it so much. So, I was thinking, all right, well, what are some of the people I really like spending time with? And it was always the plastic reconstructive surgeons, because for them, you're kind of putting everything back together the way it was. And in the grand scheme of thing, at the end of the day, anybody ever wants to do is just kind of feel good in their own skin, right? So I really enjoyed that. And so I applied for plastic reconstructive surgery out of that. And got in at University Hospital where I met you.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Okay, so you first did general surgery residency first?
I did, yeah. I did that up in the New Jersey, New York City area.
Okay, you did that for 2 years?
I actually did that for a full six.
Oh, you did 6 years of general surgery, and then, so you applied after your residency in general surgery.
Yeah, so you had to apply, my fourth year or so.
Okay.
And then got in, and it was you know, a blessing because, right, I'm living up there in New York, New Jersey area, which was a lot of fun, but I'm from Texas.
Yeah.
It's just different up there. It's just different. So when I got back into a plastic reconstructive residency down here in San Antonio, oh, man, I was over the moon. I was like, I get to go home.
Yeah.
I get to go back to Texas.
Yeah. So general surgery residency, how was that? I mean, training with these folks in residency, just looking at their schedules, always on call. It's a crazy lifestyle. How brutal was the training in general surgery residency?
I mean, I could have had it worse. Because my general surgery residency was at a place, it was in Long Branch, New Jersey. So Monmouth Medical Center. That hospital is two streets away from the beach. So I had it pretty good, right? Like, yeah, you'd work pretty long hours. I mean, you'd be on call for 24 hours sometimes. I mean, they probably don't want me to say this, but that you know, sometimes you're up, you know, 24 to 36 hours. Like, you're up a pretty good long time. And, so by the time, you know, you're done and tired, you've gone home getting a little sleep, you know, I could go to the beach and just hang out. So that was pretty nice. But the training regimen of it, yeah, it's pretty intense. I mean, you're always at the hospital no matter what you do. Like, pretty much my whole life revolved around being at the hospital. So for a good 6 years, that was my whole life, and didn't really leave a lot of time for dating or things like that. So I mean, I ended up having to meet my wife on Match.com. So
that actually good old Match,
right? Match.com. So it worked out pretty well. But yeah, the training is pretty intense because, you know, there's a lot at stake with surgery, as you know. So you want to make sure that you know as much as you can, so that way when you get out, then, you know, if you run into an issue, you've already probably seen something like that and you can handle it pretty easily.
Yeah. So do you think your that 6 years of general surgery training helped you be a better plastic surgeon?
I think so. I mean, what you end up being able to do is you end up being able to kind of triage patients like, all right, is this patient going to be at a higher risk for complications from this, right? I'm always looking at patients like the sky is falling, like everything's wrong until it's not wrong. It has to all be in a line. It has to be perfectly set up for those patients to be able to go to the operating room with me. So I think that's where that general surgery training came into play. And, you know, if something feels off a little bit, you kind of get this feeling on the back of your neck, so to speak, that, you know, all right, maybe we shouldn't be doing this, or maybe we need to change something to make this a little bit safer.
Yeah, because some people may not know this, but there are a few different routes that you can take to get to plastic surgery.
Yeah.
Can you talk about some of those
different routes? Yeah, so when you come right out of medical school, right, there's two different paths you can go down. You can do like I did, where you go into the general surgery training, and you spend typically about 5 years in general surgery training. And then from there, you go into 3 years of plastics and reconstructive surgery. The other option then is you go into kind of the integrated program. So right out of medical school, you're going into a plastics program. You're probably going to spend like 2, maybe 3 years. I don't know. They may have changed it since then, but a couple of years in general surgery training. And then the rest of that is all plastic reconstructive surgery. So, and then you have kind of the more controversial path to becoming a plastic surgeon, or quote unquote plastic surgeon. It's, you know, you do any other type of residency, you know, pediatrics,
orthopedics,
orthopedics, spine surgery, and then one day you wake up and decide, you know what, I'm going to do cosmetic surgery.
Ah, so it's possible. I can be a plastic surgeon at this point.
You absolutely, I mean, there's nothing holding you back, right? I mean, you totally could. So that's kind of a little bit more controversial. Like, yeah, you have a ton of surgical training and things like that, but, right, have you had the training in the aesthetics and kind of knowing how to handle the complications? It's kind of that sort of stuff. So you do find certain physicians get in trouble with it, like dermatologists, they'll get in trouble. You know, there was a dancing dermatologist that got her license removed, right? There was a pediatrician that was doing liposuction, I think just this year, someone actually, that patient actually died. Wow. So, you know, there's things that can happen with those kind of things. So it gets really important to kind of check and see what the training is of your surgeon, because you never know. It could be your family practice physician. There's a family practice physician in Miami that does tons of liposuction. He's pretty good at it. But he's just not, he's not even a trained surgeon. He just did some courses.
Huh. So that brings up a really interesting point. What should patients look for when they're searching for plastic surgeons online? Is there a certification or some type of specific training that their surgeons should have?
Yeah. I mean, they should be board certified or board eligible plastic surgeon for the American Board of Plastic Surgery. That would be ideal. The other thing you're looking for is, you know, their before and afters, make sure that they do those procedures on a regular basis. The other thing too is look at their reviews, and you're going to get a good idea of what type of surgeon or what your interaction, the whole process for that procedure is going to be when you look at their reviews. And then the other thing too is, you know, do you actually get to meet that surgeon before your surgery? So are you meeting that surgeon on the first time you go in for a consult, or are you meeting that surgeon 5 minutes before you go under the knife? Like, there's a whole gamut of in the field of plastic and reconstructive, or at least plastic and cosmetic surgery, where, you know, you probably may just meet the surgeon 5 minutes before. You're probably not paying a lot for that surgery. You're probably getting that at a really discounted price. But then again, like, what's the aftercare for that? So there's a lot of things in the cosmetic field of plastic surgery that can be kind of scandalous, just kind of sketchy sometimes.
Yeah. Especially, you know, we're seeing online a lot these days about patients that are traveling internationally to get plastic surgery. You know, it may save, I don't know, a couple $1,000s to get a breast lift or, you know, a BBL. What are your thoughts on kind of international plastic surgery?
I mean, you know, the United States is not the end all be all of cosmetic surgery, right? Like, you know, Brazilian butt lift, Brazil, you know, there are great surgeons all over the world, and there are great places to get plastic surgery. And yeah, it's a lot less expensive in other parts of the world. The problem that you run into, and this happened to me probably 3-4 weeks ago, right? You go somewhere else to get plastic surgery, and then you have a complication. So I had a young lady in her 30s. She came back from Miami, didn't go international, but she went to Miami. almost international, but she developed a hematoma in her breast, and she's only 10 days out from a breast augmentation. So her surgeon's all the way in Miami, not much she can do about it. And I ended up taking her to the operating room, got her fixed up, washed out everything, and got her a new implant in there, told her about the risks and everything like that. We talked about, you know, higher risk of capsular contracture and things because she did have a hematoma. And then, you know, from there, it's like, well, now who takes care of this patient? So, and it ends up, I'm going to finish up taking care of her, you know, so that way we get to follow through. But still, at the same time, I didn't do the initial surgery. And it happens frequently up in Austin. Patients always travel. I've had patients go to the Dominican Republic and have complications from tummy tucks. Actually, if I think about it, majority of them have been from Miami for some reason.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I guess the majority.
I have a good friend who's a plastic surgeon in Miami. Hopefully, those are not his patients. But right.
But you know, when she told me like who her plastic surgeon was, and I was like, I've never heard of that person. She's like, well, he's got this award. And I'm like, okay, I've never even heard of that award before. But so that's the other aspect too. Like surgeons can buy awards online. Like, I mean, I would love to make a YouTube video where I become like Austin's best plastic surgeon, where I just go online and buy the award and boom, there you go.
Yeah. Or the plastic surgeons that have a lot of followers.
Right.
So, and then patients may go to that surgeon just because of their following or, you know, social media kind of presence. But you said for patients and anyone that's interested in plastic surgery, just make sure, do your research.
Yeah.
Make sure that you look at the reviews, make sure that the plastic surgeon is board eligible or board certified in the American Board of Plastic Surgery.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, exactly. So just do your homework on who you're going to see and go with who you're most comfortable with. I mean, if they've got all the credentials and everything like that, then hey, by all means, have plastic surgery with the surgeon that you want. Just make sure you do your homework first.
Yeah. And then I guess I don't know if it's because of social media is coming more mainstream these days. It just seems like there's a lot of people going into cosmetics. And why do you think that is? You think that's an insurance push, you know, commercial insurance? That's really what I take. And reimbursements are declining. Why do you think so many people are going into cosmetics these days?
I really do think it's a big push from the insurance. Like the reimbursements are going down. I mean, you know, it just, as all that goes down, you're now looking for ways to kind of support or supplement your income. And cosmetics is a great way to do that because it's all cash pay, right? They're typically happier patients in general to handle and deal with. So, you know, the atmosphere is a little different too. So I think a lot of that has to do with kind of the reimbursements and then kind of seeing that lifestyle that cosmetic field can bring you. Cause yeah, it's all cash pay. So, you know, you're not relying on the insurance company to make sure that they come through with that check and then, or you get that denial check and then you got to deal with all of that. Like, I mean, I think I got a check maybe last year that was for 7 cents. And I was like, it's a waste of my time to even go deposit this check.
Or the paper costs more than 7 cents.
Right, probably. Exactly. So like, I just kind of put that check away. I was like, nah, we're not even going to deal with that.
Yeah. I mean, do you take any insurance at this point?
I do. Cause I do some reconstructive surgery. Okay. So mostly kind of reconstructive patients from trauma. So I cover two different hospitals in Austin, one all the way up in Round Rock, one on the south side of Austin. So yeah, I still take some insurance based stuff. And, you know, it's really rewarding to do the reconstructive stuff because those patients, they're just trying to get back to their normal life after they've had some horrific accident, things like that. Or, you know, you're trying to reconstruct some sort of cancer or anything like that, you know, surgery that they've had before. So all those patients ever want to do is just get back to feeling normal again. And with that, it's really rewarding. But on the downside of that, yeah, it's the insurance company you got to deal with, like prior authorizations or denials and things like that. So it gets a little bit frustrating on that end. And I think that's part of the reason why you're seeing a bigger kind of push into cosmetic surgery from patients or physicians that are not in the field to begin with, which makes sense. I mean, I would want to do the same thing. You got student loans to pay back. You got a family to support.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely agree. You know, what percentage of your practice is kind of cash pay, like 90%, you think?
I think probably maybe about 80% or so. Yeah.
Man, that's the dream. Cause you know, dealing with insurance companies, challenging.
Yeah.
You know, you pay all this money to have health insurance, but when it's time to use it, the insurance just gives you the hardest time ever. Gotcha. You know, I have to fight and sit on the phone and talk to adjusters and insurance companies and do appeals to get patients approved for surgery that need it, that have like severe spinal compression or severe nerve pain down their arm or their leg. they've done maybe some physical therapy, injections, and physical, the insurance company will think of everything that they can to try to deny a surgery. And it's quite frustrating. And then you do the surgery and like sometimes 6 months go by and they still haven't paid you.
Yeah.
Or I've had some surgeries that I've done last year and I still have not been paid. So it's quite frustrating. You know, I wish I can have a 80% of my patients just pay cash for their surgery. Maybe I'll do a concierge practice in Dubai or something like that in the future.
You more than likely could, but I mean, no, I get it too, because I'm glad I'm not the only one. Like, you know, you do some big reconstructive surgery and then a year and a half later that check shows up and you're like, who was that even for?
Yep.
You have to go back digging through the numbers to kind of see what it was like. Oh, that one. Yeah, that was 18 months ago.
Yeah, and I saw something recently also about insurance companies, even if they approve the surgery and pay you for it, they have a part of their company that will go back and review to make sure that it was legitimate surgery, and they can take that money back.
Correct.
So I don't know what the name of that is, but I saw that, and it just kind of blew my mind that insurance companies, they try to do everything they can to have the patient not be able to utilize their benefits, but also pay the people that are actually providing the care.
Yeah.
So you did your general surgery residency, and then you went to plastic surgery residency at UT Health in San Antonio. How was your time there, your experience?
It was, again, you've got 3 short years to kind of squeeze in everything you need to know about plastic surgery, right? So again, it was pretty intense. I mean, really long days. You're taking home call, but it's not really like, you're getting called in every few hours. So you're going into the hospital and you're getting to see some pretty wild and crazy things. I mean, like, you know, on the reconstructive side, you're doing free flaps and all these things, head and neck reconstruction, lower extremity, upper extremity reconstruction. So all that stuff was a great time. I mean, and 3 years goes by really fast. And then, you know, at the same time, you're getting the exposure to all the cosmetic surgery too. So it was a really good mix. I mean, the nice thing about being at University Hospital was, you know, we're kind of relatively close to the US-Mexico border, right? So you get patients coming in from Mexico. They're getting flown in from Mexico, or you're getting patients from Lubbock. So pretty far, in terms of Texas, kind of far away places. I mean, I don't know, Lubbock is like, what, 6-8 hours from here, and you're still in the state of Texas. So you're getting patients from all over coming into the University Hospital. And that's what really made it for a great experience, because you're getting to see a ton of things that you probably wouldn't have gotten to see anywhere else. And you wouldn't think that being in San Antonio.
Yeah. Do you think 3 years was enough time to kind of get everything that you need to know for becoming a plastic surgeon?
It was, I mean, with having a general surgery background and then spending that 3 years kind of focusing, well, not kind of, but really focusing on reconstructive surgery. Yeah, because you already had a really good foundation that you've already built on, right? So you know about getting patients ready for the operating room. Really, it was kind of dialing in the hand surgery aspect of it, because you didn't do any of that in general surgery. And then the head and neck reconstruction, the free flap. So it was basically going from being a general surgeon where, you know, you're using pretty big instruments and, you know, pretty heavy instruments, to plastics where everything's really delicate and fine movement. So the instruments got a lot smaller.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that part got a little bit, you know, took a little bit getting used to. But once you do, it's now when somebody hands me like a regular needle driver, I'm like, I'll take the smaller one.
Yeah, but very similar for orthopedics. You know, we do get some spine surgery training in orthopedics, but most of it's kind of muscle skeletal, joint replacement, ACLs, hip replacements. And then we do a 1-year spine fellowship. But I think I've learned the most actually just being in practice, just doing surgeries and, you know, figuring out what works, what doesn't work, you know, having a complication here and kind of learning from that, or working with my mentors, the people that are my senior partners who have taught me a lot. That's where I learned the most about being a spine surgeon.
Yeah. Really. Yeah. That first couple of years out of training, I think, the everything that you've learned on the inside, I guess when you call it residency, right? Everything you learn from there, then you start to really get to apply it in your own way once you get out. Because before, like, right, as a resident, I kind of found, all right, well, I need to do it this way because that's the way the attending does it. And it works for them. But then, you know, when you get out of training, now you're like, all right, I can do this on my own. I can do this the way that I want to. And yeah, you start to figure out how this works and works a little bit better for you, so that it works better for you and your patients.
Yeah. Yeah. And then going back to your medical school, you went to medical school over St. George's?
Yeah, I went to St. George's University on the Caribbean, on the island of Grenada.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, a lot of people, I get emails all the time from students that are kind of go to medical schools outside of the U.S. And they're always wondering if, you know, certainly if it's possible. And you're kind of a testament to that it is certainly it's possible to get into or match into a very competitive field. Like, what would you give, like, advice for students out there that, you know, go to schools outside of the U.S. and they want to get into a competitive specialty?
I mean, I think the number one thing that you're told all the time whenever you go to a foreign medical school is you're never going to get into any of the specialties. You're going to be family practice and that's it. And then not that there's anything wrong with that, right? But if, you know, people try and shoot you down to be like, all right, well, you went to a foreign medical school. So, I mean, where does the rest of the world go to a medical school, right? And they're going to foreign schools to us. So, but, you know, that's the number one thing is don't let anybody tell you what you can't do. Cause that was it for me. Like, if you tell me I can't do something, sit back and watch, cause I'm going to do it. Yeah. So, you know, as long as you have that drive and that determination, you can get it done. You put in the hours, you put your head down and get the scores that you need. Yeah. You'll get there. I think there's me and I know three other plastic surgeons that went to St. George's.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then I know a number of orthopedic surgeons that went to St. George's University.
Yeah.
It is totally possible.
Yeah. And I've never had had a patient ask me where to go to medical school. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't really come up. I mean, patients, they don't really care about stuff like that. I mean, as long as you're a good doctor taking good care of patients and, you know, you listen to your patients and take good care of them, they don't really care where you went to medical school.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think I've been asked like maybe one time I think that one time I told them, I don't think they really kind of recognized where that was. So it really wasn't even a conversation after that.
Yeah. What was the craziest thing you saw kind of in residency and then also for your general surgery residency and also plastic surgery, like crazy injury or some type of, something that you remember back?
Man, there's two that I think back to on a regular basis. One was in Newark, New Jersey, when I was doing my general surgery training. There was a guy that came in and I got a call from the ER while I'm on call. And I think I'm like a fourth year resident, right? So it's just me and the intern on call. And hey, we got a guy with a gunshot wound to the head. And I'm like, okay, why are you calling me? Like, shouldn't this guy be going? Because our hospital wasn't really set. We didn't have neurosurgeons. So they're like, well, he's down here. He's totally normal. He's talking just fine. Like nothing happened. I'm like, all right, let me come downstairs and check. So I go with him to the CT scanner and kind of the initial X-ray pops up before the scan pops up, right? And you can see the bullet sitting right in the, looks like center of the head. And I'm like, oh boy, okay. We probably need to get this guy out of here. But again, he's talking just totally normal. Well, turns out he'd been sitting in his car and when he got shot, it came through the window and just kind of went in. Plus he's a pretty obese guy. So he had a lot of padding in there. So it didn't break through the cranium, right? It's just kind of sitting between the skin in there. And he's just talking, having a great time. And he's like, you're going to get this thing out? I'm like, absolutely not. No way. And I explained to him, like, once you get shot or it goes through something, right, the bullet fragments a little bit. It gets kind of these sharp ridges and things like that. So you can cause more problems pulling it out than just leaving it there. So, you know, I told the ER team, just leave it there. We're not going to go after this thing. And sure enough, after I left, the ER team's like, no, we're going to go get this bullet. And they sure enough started some pretty intense bleeding while they were trying to pull this thing out. And they called me back and I'm like, I told y'all to leave that thing alone. So we had to go downstairs and deal with that. In plastics training, the craziest thing I think I saw was, I think it was like maybe my first couple weeks in training there. I'm just starting to get the grasp of hand surgery and stuff like that. But there's a young guy who's walking down the stairs and on the railings kind of going down, he fell. So he went to grab the railings, but he missed the top and the little pillars that go up and down. Mm-hmm. He went to grab that, but his pinkies got caught like right in between those. Right. And I say pinky, I shouldn't be saying that as a hand surgeon, right? But his small finger gets stuck in there, pinky for everybody else. But his small fingers get stuck in there and rips both of the small fingers off, pulls those off with the tendons, spaghetti, like it looks like spaghetti just hanging off with a finger. And they put him in a bag and they bring him in. And when that happens, whenever you pull a finger off and the whole tendon from the forearm comes out with it, there's really no putting that back in there. So I'd explain to him, like, I'm sorry, we can't reattach these. I'd already called the attending just to make sure. Because I was, you know, fresh, brand new plastics reconstructive intern or resident at that time. And he was like, no, there's no putting those back on. So I had to go explain to him, like, hey, I'm sorry, you're going to be minus two fingers for the rest of your life. So
yeah.
You get to the point where, you know, you have to have intense conversations with people that are going to, are going to change their life. And you have to be able to present it in a good way for these people, because you can't just go in there and be bluntly like, sorry, dude, you don't get your fingers back.
Well, Dr. Pierce, you're a plastic surgeon. I mean, you can't put my finger back on and sew it back on.
I mean, we could, right? But it's going to be like this inoperative stump that's just going to get in the way of things. Yeah. So that's kind of, you know, the way it is with fingers and stuff. Either they work or they don't. And if they do work, they're great. If they don't, they're in the way.
Yep, I definitely agree. So you finished your plastic surgery residency, and then did you always know while you were in residency that you wanted to start your own practice, or did you ever consider like joining a hospital or you know, academic at all?
When I was in my general surgery residency, I knew that I did not want to join a practice, like be the new guy in a practice. And the reason being is because I always saw these new guys come out of training. They would join these established practices and then they just got dumped on. Like just, I mean, and that's a nice way of putting it, right?
Yeah, I agree.
So I saw that and I was like, wait, I'm putting in all these years of training and then I'm just going to join some other practice to still be the low man on the totem pole again. I was like, if I'm going to have it raining on me, I might as well just be my own rain, right? So that's why I was like, let me open up my own practice. To join like an academic institution, I think after my general surgery residency and then kind of the plastics reconstructive field, right? Just the academic field of medicine is kind of, it can be toxic at times. And that's not really my personality. I'm very easygoing. I'd rather, you know, everybody be happy. And some of that politics and that stuff makes that whole environment kind of toxic sometimes. And that wasn't for me either. So I was like, all right, let me open up my own practice. Let's do that. And that has been a challenge in itself too.
Yeah. And what was the hardest part about starting your practice? And when did you like start it? Did you start like your first year plastic surgery residency and then just kind of slowly got the website, look for an office space? What was that process like?
Yeah, I mean, it was probably my second year. I was like, all right, I think that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to open up my own practice and then kind of figure out where it was going to be. And once we settled on Austin, then it was like, okay, well, now I got to find an office. But first you got to do like all the things behind in the background, right? You got to set up your tax ID and all these other things that you have no training with whatsoever. So, you know, in that regard, if anybody's ever going to do that, you know, make sure you hire a good lawyer or a good CPA to do that. Cause if you don't, that can be a whole nightmare in itself. But once you get all that stuff into play, then you can start finding, well, first you got to get the loan. So you got to come up with a business plan. Nobody ever teaches us how to do a business plan in residency. So you got to figure out how to do that. I went on the internet and just kind of researched over and over, found some templates and kind of based my business plan off of that, presented that to the bank, and shout out to Frost Bank who helped me set up mine. So, but once I got set up with that, once you got the loan secured, then you can start getting everything else. So the next thing to do is find an office space. And you don't really want to start out with like a huge office because nobody knows you in town. So you don't want to load yourself up with all these expenses. And then the hardest part then is really finding the team, putting together the team to work with you. Because everybody has to, you know, work together. They have to congeal. You don't want to have infighting in the office and things like that. You want to make sure those people are dependable. I've had an office manager my first few years out. Whenever I was in the operating room, she would show up. She would get her facial or whatever done with the esthetician and then she would go home. And I didn't really realize that was going on at first until I realized it. So, you know, that's why she doesn't work there anymore. But, you know, it can be difficult. And I think the human factor is the one that makes it the most difficult because that one is the most unpredictable. You can do your budgets, you can do your finances, all those things, as long as you're controlling that. But the human factor is, you know, your other people that you're working with. So you just can't control all that all the time.
Yeah. So how many employees do you have now working for you?
I have three right now.
Three?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, we're about to be down to two because like I said, you know, my medical assistant, she just put in her 2 weeks. She's going to move on to do something else. So we're going to be hiring here pretty soon.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, in private practice is, you know, not to that extreme. We certainly have, not to the extent like a hospital, I have a lot of resources and HR department, admins, you got all these people that can assist in hiring new people or, kind of help running the practice. Like you're essentially doing that all your own.
Yeah.
And I can imagine just, you know, it's frustrating to maybe get a text message and, you know, from one of my medical assistants, hey, I won't be able to make it in today, or I'm sick, or, you know, my nurse practitioner who last week called in because she was dizzy, things like that.
Yeah.
So it gets kind of frustrating dealing with that. And I can imagine just having a practice and, having to have all of that responsibility on yourself. What was it like that first few weeks and, how long did it take to like kind of build up to a point where do you feel like you're kind of at the level that you want to be at for your practice at 6 years in?
No, I mean, I think you always want to be better than where you are. Right. And it's really hard to kind of sit back and look like, okay, well, look how far you've come. But you're always looking at like, all right, looking at, you know, the outside, like, why don't I have my own building or why don't I have my own operative suite yet? Those kind of things. And those things all come with time and everybody's on their own journey. So, yeah, I mean, I do wish that some things were better in regard for my practice and other things I'm really happy about. So those things, you know, it kind of all balances itself out. I mean, I could close down the office and go to the lake for the whole day if I really wanted to. Not smart because I know how much money I'm going to lose for that day, but it's an option that I have, you know, having my own practice.
Yeah. And how many hours do you typically work per week now and having your own practice?
I mean, I'm probably still putting in like closer residency hours, like 80 hours a week. Cause like, you know, once the day is done, I write all my notes at the end of the day. And then after that, then I'll look through the finances. I'll look through payroll. I'll look through, and then I got to look at the website. So it's like all these things. And, you know, as the practice grows, sure, I'm going to hire somebody to do that a little bit more. But for the meantime, I still like to stay on top of that and kind of see how things are progressing.
Yeah. And then I guess when you were choosing locations, like to put your office, did you take into account like how many plastic surgeons are kind of in this area so that, you know, do you consider that at all?
To a small extent, like I kind of checked and made sure that there was no other plastic surgeons in the building. There are now. There's two great plastic surgeons downstairs for me, and I enjoy seeing them every time they're there. But yeah, I kind of just looked like, okay, am I going to be the only guy in this building? Great, that's awesome. You know, there's a whole Austin itself has so many cosmetic plastic surgeons. I mean, it's a pretty kind of stacked field there, right? So you can't really go too far without running into somebody else or having somebody else across the street.
Yeah. So I guess, how do you get that competitive advantage compared to other plastic surgeons? Like, how do you, like, what are you, some of the things that you're doing to kind of get yourself out there?
I mean, for me, it's a lot of marketing and then, you know, handing out your business cards, shaking hands, saying hi to people, you know, forming relationships with other physicians that can refer to you as well. One of the main things that's really helped me out the most is just YouTube. Like, you know, when I met you because you had a YouTube channel, I just stumbled across your YouTube channel one day because I was trying to develop my own. And YouTube has really, really kind of set our practice on a different trajectory because, you know, I'll put out videos on a topic and then suddenly I've got a consult from somebody in Kentucky that wants to talk to me about their issue. And we do a video chat, you know, video chat or video consult for that. And the next thing you know, they're in the office. So like yesterday I did surgery on someone from California and then Maryland. So I've had patients coming in from all over. So it's been pretty impressive just being on YouTube alone and being able to do that educational content. Patients feel like, all right, this guy, you know, he knows what he's talking about. Let me go talk with him. And then from there, once we have that conversation, I'm a pretty personable guy. I like to talk to people. It's not a cut and dry kind of conversation. So, you know, I think that part actually helps out too. It's just, you have to know how to talk to people in the cosmetic field.
Yeah, exactly. It's certainly customer service. And I totally agree about your comment on YouTube. Very powerful. I don't know what percentage of my practice is actually patients that travel in, probably maybe 20% travel in to see me. And they come in, they feel like they know you because they, you know, they've seen and watched your videos. I was in clinic today and I had at least four or five patients that say, hey, I've seen your videos. I know all about you, Dr. Webb. And there was one guy who came in, I think he lives about 6 hours away, and he came down to have surgery. And as we were rolling into the surgical suite, he was talking to the anesthesiologist and I was talking to the anesthesiologist and the OR staff. I think I was new, fresh out of training. And then I guess someone had asked me, hey, how many years have you been in practice? And I said, probably a year and a half. And he was like, no, you've been in practice for 2.5 years. I've watched every one of your videos. So, definitely patience. It's very powerful. It just, you know, you put out a video and, you know, it ends up somewhere overseas. I get emails from Canada, from China, Nigeria, kind of from all over. So very, very, very powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. And the one aspect that I love about it too is, you know, setting up your post-op instructions. Just, all right, here's the video. We're going to talk about this, but here's the video if you need to review it afterwards. And that's been a big time saver for me because, you know, you find yourself repeating the same post-op instructions over and over. Like now I can kind of, all right, here's what it is, but here's the video if you have any questions. And even if you have questions after that, just let me know.
Yep.
But it helps out quite a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. What are some of the common procedures that you do, surgeries? What are you typically doing these days?
So I kind of split it up between men and women. So for women, I do a lot of body contouring. And then for some reason, I've done a lot of breast augmentation lifts. So not just plain old, just regular breast augmentation. It's the breast lift with an augmentation. And that one, I really enjoy doing that because there's a little bit more complexity to it where you have to figure out or kind of plan ahead of time where that nipple areolar complex is going to land on the breast. Because initially, once you do a breast augmentation, everything's kind of up in the chest, upper chest area, and then the implants will drop from there. And then you really have to gauge, okay, where exactly is that nipple areolar complex going to land on that implant? Is it going to be too high? Is it going to be way too low? So that's a little bit more of a challenge, and I really enjoy doing that. And then from there, I'll do a lot of arm lifts and liposuction, skinny Brazilian butt lifts, which are a little different than your 2014 Kim Kardashian Brazilian butt lift, right? It's not like the bubble butt. It's more of just kind of a natural enhancement to it, so which are pretty nice because the patients tend to be a little skinnier. So, you know, that makes it to where we got to watch how much we take. We can't take too much because you don't want to overdo it. But at the same time, you need to get enough to have an effect to fill in the hip dips or get a little bit more projection. So that's always enjoyable. For the guys, it kind of splits between, you know, gynecomastia surgery. So a lot of guys have extra tissue on the chest where they just don't want to take their shirt off in public because, you know, I remember too, like in my 20s, you know, you read Men's Health magazine, you're like, why don't I look like that guy on the cover? I've been hitting the gym forever. I haven't seen the gym in years now, but still, like, you know, you're looking at that health, you know, Men's Health cover model. You're like, why don't I look like that guy? I put in the work, and it can be because of gynecomastia, which is just a benign amount of tissue on the chest. So just taking those out alone, the improvement in guys' confidence goes through the roof. It's so great to see in the postoperative period. And then the other aspect too is hair transplants. And that is a big confidence booster for guys and for the ladies too. But, you know, once you give somebody their hair back, just that confidence goes back up too. And that's what I really like to see. I've had guys come through my office. They won't look my staff in the eye because they're all female. They, you know, they're missing their hair. They're wearing their caps. And then a year later, they come back through after a hair transplant. And I've had a couple of them ask out my staff on dates on their last visit. So, you know, that boost, I see it. It's there. So yeah. I don't think any of them have taken them up on it, but you know, it's good to see that.
Yeah, that's awesome. What's your favorite surgery to do?
For me, I mean, yeah, it's going to be gynecomastia surgery for guys. The other one is chin liposuction. So that one's kind of personal for me, right? Because I've got a little extra here. It's genetic. It just won't go away. I've just recently lost like 40 pounds, right? And it's still kind of here. So just by doing that too, again, people love their profile. I mean, you know, we spend a lot of time taking selfies and things like that. And a lot of people will take that selfie from up high because they don't want to show that double chin, right? So now patients, you know, after they get their chin liposuction, it has to be the right patient. Some patients need a facelift or neck lift to go along with that. And other patients can just have chin lipo alone. Not everybody is a candidate for that. But once you do that and you give somebody back that jawline, then they spend less time worrying about that. And next thing you know, they might end up looking at something else on their body and focus on that now. So, you know, it can kind of change where the focus is. But overall, just that a improvement in the jawline, everybody loves that. Everybody loves a fresh jawline.
Yeah. One of the things I kind of worry about plastic surgery is just managing expectations. You know, people come in and they're paying cash. They want things to look a certain way, or they may come in with Kim Kardashian photo, say, hey, I want to look like this. Do you find yourself kind of, battling, just trying to meet their expectations? And what do you do when a patient comes back after you do a breast augmentation or a butt lift and they just, man, I don't like this. Like, yeah. What do you do?
Yeah, that is the hardest part of cosmetic surgery because you're constantly trying to manage expectations. And no matter how much you may have talked about it pre-op and you told them directly to their face, you looked them in the eye and told them, you know, you're not going to look like that photo, but we're going to try and get you close, but you may not end up looking like that. And then they come back a few months later and they're like, I don't look like this photo. It's like, we had that conversation. So that just may go completely over their head, but that's the hardest part because for me, like I take it personally when I don't meet their expectations and it's happened before. And what you end up doing is, you know, you got to have a good conversation before and after the procedure. Before, just to make sure that you're both on the same page, because they might be thinking something and you might have another thing in mind. So you might miss on that regard. The other aspect too is, you know, they might understand like, hey, we're going to get to this point, but they feel like it should have been further. And maybe that's not even possible for their anatomy, but they don't really understand that. They blame you for that. So it's kind of tough in that regard. So what I end up doing typically, because I've had it happen before, is you talk to them. All right, well, you're not happy with it. I understand. I can see where you're coming from on that. We have to wait to the 6-month mark. And usually at the 6-month mark, typically things will either improve to the point where we don't have to do anything and they're happy. Or if we get to that 6-month mark and they're still not happy, well, then you got to come up with a plan to help them get to that point or have a really good conversation. And sometimes a hard conversation that you're not the surgeon for them, that you can't get them to that point. And that can go well sometimes, especially if you handle it with the right conversation. And sometimes it's not a pretty picture, but it's hard.
Yeah. And how much is like diet and exercise? Because I imagine, you know, someone gets liposuction and BBL and or some type of butt lift and breast aug, they may feel like they don't have to work out, and all of a sudden they start eating crazy, and it just screws up your results. How much is that involved, and is that important?
Yeah, that's a big factor. I've had a couple patients where, you know, we've done tummy tucks and lipo, and they look great, and then they come in at the 1 year mark, and where are my results? Like, what happened? I was all excited to talk to you about using your before and afters, and then here we are. So they're like, oh, you know, my partner, you know, my boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, they're a really great cook. So I've just been eating a lot. And I'm like, well, okay. Yeah. I mean, I wish our results had stayed like from 6 months to a year, like a lot can change. So yeah, that diet and exercise, because once you invest in yourself and you invest in the surgery that you're going to have, you have to maintain that. And a lot of people don't really think like, oh, I can just get the surgery and I'm good to go. I don't ever have to think about it again, but you do. It's like brushing your teeth. You know, if you don't want to keep your teeth healthy, you don't brush them. But if you know, as long as you do, you get to keep the results. You get to keep your teeth.
Yeah. And I definitely agree about the patient expectations, just meeting those. I try to ask every patient before surgery, like, what do you hope to gain from this surgery? And some patients would be like, hey, I want to go run a marathon. I was like, did you run a marathon before this? Yeah. Or they may have some crazy expectation, and I'll tell them, no, that's not what we're doing. This surgery is going to get rid of your leg pain.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to fix, you know, you picking up your arm and this rotator cuff in your shoulder, rotator cuff tear or something like that. So managing expectation is really critical. And I think that should be part of every surgeon's kind of consultation, make sure that's kind of discussed.
Yeah.
And what about, any patients like in spine surgery, you know, there's some patients, they walk in, they may have some pathology there, but I'm very critical about who I operate on and touch, just because there are a lot of psychosocial things that could be going on. They may be not the healthiest patient. How often do you have to turn down a patient for surgery that came in and say, hey, I'm paying cash, I want this done?
Yeah. I mean, that's hard, 'cause you know that's a cash paying patient, right? But at the same time, you've got to look at that, especially with cosmetic surgery, right? Because once you operate on that patient and you have a relationship forever. So you really have to kind of keep your eyes open for red flags. Like, why are you doing the surgery? What, you know, exactly, what are you hoping to achieve here? You know, is their partner sitting in the corner of the room over there doing all the talking about what they should be getting and how they should look? That's a big red flag right there. Like, that's an automatic, like, no, you probably need to go find another surgeon. I'm not the right one for you. The other one is, and most people don't really realize this, but your consult starts the minute you walk in the door and the minute you start talking to the front desk staff. Because I've had people come to us for consults from out of town and things like that. And my office is not the biggest office, so I can hear what's going on up in the front, and I can hear how patients are talking to my front staff. And my front staff will come back and tell me, and they're like, this person's been rude the whole time they've been here. So, you know, if you're not treating the front desk staff or, you know, everybody else in the office with, you know, respect and dignity, that puts out a big red flag too, because what happens if your surgery doesn't meet your expectations? How are you going to treat everybody then? So there's a lot of things you have to watch out for in cosmetic surgery. You kind of have to, you know, almost, I mean, be a psychologist and be able to kind of field out all these kind of pathologies in the psych realm.
Yeah, I totally agree. But there's this huge surgeons online about BBLs. What's this whole craze about BBLs? And is that something that you offer? And what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, BBLs they've been around for a while. You know, they've kind of gone through this evolution where, you know, early, 2010s, 2012, 2014, it was go as big as you could, go big or go home. And, you know, you see that in videos and, you know, seeing that Kim Kardashian, there's all sorts, right? And now the trend has been going kind of more of a natural look, like enhanced, but not so much like the butt is bringing the whole attention to, you know, everything else. So it's kind of that evolution that's been pretty good. So, you know, in the other aspect of it too, is with patients that lose a lot of weight, right? If they lose a lot of weight, they lose it in their butt as well. And when you have that silhouette, that shape, it's what's, you know, deemed as attractive. Our brains automatically see some of those curvatures in the opposite sex as more attractive. So you want to see some of those curves back. And by doing that, one of the ways you can do it is with a Brazilian butt lift, where we take fat from other areas and we transfer it to the butt. And, it is, you know, a really rewarding surgery to do. It's also one of the more dangerous ones if it's done incorrectly, because there's a risk of getting the fat injected into one of the larger veins in the buttock area, right? So once you get fat in there, then it can go to the heart, lungs, anywhere else, and it could kill you. So in recent years, the death rate has come down from that quite a bit, because it's gone through an evolution where now we're starting to use like ultrasound to know where we are when we're putting that fat in. We're not putting it in the muscle anymore. And that's where it was going typically, like in the early stages. But now with everything getting safer, patients now aren't really wanting so much of that. They don't want that huge, but some people do. It's not really my patients, but some people do. So my patients, typically they want a little bit more enhancement. They want kind of a naturally enhanced butt. And with that, we're filling in really the hip dips, because those can kind of cause some changes in the shape of a woman. A lot of women, sometimes they'll be really skinny, but they'll carry a lot of fat just in the posterior flanks back here. And if we just take that, and really a lot of the skinny BBL, if we take the lower back and sculpt that out, that really is going to help enhance the upper buttock area and also just give the appearance of more projection. So then once we take some fat and inject that in there, then you get an even better result.
Yeah, you know, some of these women that are walking around, I mean, it just looks crazy.
Yeah.
Me and my wife were in New Orleans a couple of weeks ago, and I was looking out the window, and my wife was like in the front doing something else. I had to call her over. I said, come look at this lady's butt. It's the biggest butt I have ever seen in my life. I thought it was like another human on the back of her back.
It can get wild. I mean, there's you have to be able to tell the patient, like, all right, you've had enough.
Yep.
And some surgeons just won't do that. They'll be like, all right, let's just keep going. And it's not really the right thing to do, but you wind up with results that look like that.
Yeah. What's a typical day for you as a plastic surgeon?
For me, waking up in the morning, I get up about 5:30 in the morning, depending on if I'm going to try and do a little running on the treadmill or not. I've kind of been lacking on that lately, but 5:30 or so, get ready, get the kids up, get them off to either school or camp or something like that during the summer. And then I'm usually at work by like 8:30 or 9. I'll sit down, kind of look over what the day is going to be like. And then from 9 till about 4 p.m., we're seeing patients just all the way through. And that's usually about 2.5 days a week. The other 2.5 days of the week, I'm at the operating room. So either doing reconstructive or cosmetic surgery.
Yeah, awesome. What's next for you in like next 5 years for Paris plastic surgery? What's coming up?
Yeah, the next 5 years, you know, I keep debating whether or not I want to get a partner. Not sure. As you know, surgeons sometimes are not the most easiest people to work with.
Oh, man, don't say that, man. We're easy.
Some of us are. Others maybe not so much. So I keep debating on that. And then kind of getting my own office with an OR suite.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's once you have an OR suite in your office, it's a pretty nice deal. You don't really have to leave so much. I lose a lot of time traveling between all these operating rooms and things like that. So it just would make the day more efficient. It brings down the cost of things, especially for patients on the cosmetic side. But if you do that, you have to do it the right way. You need to make sure, you know, we got, you know, the accreditation and everything like that done exactly the way that it needs to be done. Because safety for me is always number one. If it's not safe, we're not doing it. I mean, I had a patient the other day, we were doing a procedure and it wasn't going the way it should. And I was like, no, we're going to stop. We're going to abandon this. We're not going to go on, because just the risk of having a complication, it was in her face. So taking out her buccal fat pad here. Just the buccal fat pad just wasn't coming out the way that it should. And I was like, you know what? I'd rather still have big puffy cheeks and be unhappy that we can get the surgery done than have facial paralysis or something like that. That's fine. I can refund her money and she'll still have a fully functioning face. It's just safety, right? Mm. So safety is number one to have your own OR suite. And then having my own building, that would be nice. I don't know. Yeah. We'll see.
Yeah, awesome. If you're looking for a partner and I decide to leave spine surgery, would you train me? Be a cosmetic spine surgeon. I'll join your practice.
I don't think you'd be the first, but we could do it. We could do it.
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't be the first. How can patients get a hold of you? Where can they find you at?
So my website is pierceplasticsurgery.com. I also have my YouTube channel, The Plastic Life with Dr. Paul Pierce. I couldn't just name it Paul Pierce because there's a basketball player. I guess he's a little bit more popular than me. And then we also have TikTok, Plastic Surgeon Pierce, and then Pierce Plastic Surgery on Instagram.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll make sure I put all of those in the show notes. But Dr. Pierce, thanks for coming to the WebMD podcast and sharing your story. Very inspiring. Just, you know, I don't get to meet too many practice owners that have, you know, successively started from the ground and kind of built a practice and, sustaining and being out there and just doing great things. So I definitely applaud you on that and congratulations on all your success.
Well, thanks, man. It was a pleasure to be here and hopefully we'll get to hang out a little bit more other than this.
Yeah, let's hit the lake sometime and get on back of that boat. But all right. Well, thank you guys for listening to the WebMD podcast. Make sure you subscribe and we'll see you on the next one.